Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. As we head into May, we're going to take an opportunity to encore a few segments we've gathered over the past 4 months that still focus on critical issues facing your community and our state. We're going to start with a previously recorded segment featuring Connecticut's new comptroller, Natalie Broswell, discussing a brand new benefit for frontline responders who may have suffered financial issues as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. If you are or know a frontline worker, you'll want to stay tuned to learn about the Connecticut Essential Worker COVID-19 Assistance Fund. Then we're going to tap an executive for the next encore segment. She's from the Connecticut League for Nursing and the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce. They partnered with our friends at CT Data to produce an incredibly important and concerning report about our state's nursing resources and how a crisis-level shortage of nurses is looming. Then we're going to close replaying a call we did during March, which is Problem Gambling Awareness Month. With Connecticut recently opening up many new ways to lay down and lose or win a bet, For the People turned to a top resource at Wheeler Health for some straight talk about what to do if you or someone you know, even a teen or young adult, is experiencing unhealthy gambling habits. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People replay with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. The annual Children's Health and Safety Fair is back for its 19th year on Sunday, May 15th from 11 to 3 at Warsaw Park in Ansonia to help families get ready for a fun and healthy summer. Griffin Hospital Community Outreach and Valley Parish Nurse Program, Safe Kids of Greater Naugatuck Valley, Griffin faculty physicians, and area health and safety organizations are offering free healthy treats, raffles, games, and information on a variety of health, wellness, and safety programs. The event will be held rain or shine, so plan to come out or learn more by calling 203-732-1337 or visiting griffinhealth.org. Well, as I was speaking with our state comptroller, Natalie Broswell, before we turned on the microphone this morning, the comptrollers here in Connecticut have been a great resource and friend to the award-winning For the People going back many, many years. And we're very, very happy to welcome you, Natalie, to the program and to the position. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So in the short time that you have been the comptroller, that does in no way mirror your experience in the comptroller's office. In fact, you were really Kevin Lembo's right-hand person there and gained much of the knowledge that kind of qualified you and made you the perfect candidate for the job because of everything that you learned from Kevin.
No, exactly. I don't know about perfect candidate for the job, but I was definitely a person that could step into this role very quickly without having a learning curve in terms of understanding the function and the mission and responsibility of the office. As you mentioned, I came in to state service in 2011 when Kevin Lembo was first elected comptroller as his general counsel and assistant comptroller. So over the 10 years that I was there working with Kevin, there wasn't much in the office that I wasn't involved with or advised on when I was there.
Hmm. Well, many people obviously have an understanding of what a comptroller does in private industry, but remind our listeners exactly what your office is charged with, because you and your team have some really important work to do.
And if your listeners are anything like I was, you know, over 10 years ago when I was first asked to be a part of the comptroller's administration, I myself didn't really have a very good understanding as to what the office did. But now I have a serious appreciation for it. The comptroller's office basically provides like all of the accounting and financial services for state government. We do things like administer the employee retirement benefits. We develop the accounting policies and exercise sort of the compliance and oversight for accounting for the state. We provide and prepare financial reports, sort of the fiscal health of the state and looking at the budget for, like, not just the state, but federal and municipal governments. And we also do something that's a little bit more unique that other comptrollers don't do, in that we administer the state health care plan for all state employees and their dependents. So that's another big role that we play, including payroll services. We make sure that folks get paid and vendors get paid. And it's a pretty big list for our agency.
Right. Well, part of the reason why we're asking to speak with you today is because of an announcement of a brand new program out of your office, and that you are certainly putting a lot of energy behind, to recognize frontline workers here in Connecticut. They've certainly made, as you said, immense sacrifices right up in front of the pack to keep our state functioning during the pandemic. They continue to do it, sometimes at great cost to them. And that is why the Connecticut Essential Workers COVID-19 Assistance Fund was launched just a few days ago as we're recording this interview. So let's talk a little bit about the germination of the idea for that kind of fund. You, having worked closely with your predecessor, Kevin Lembo, I'm sure this all started kind of germinating, you know, after we started seeing the toll that COVID-19 was taking on our essential workforce.
Exactly. And, you know, I have to give credit to Senator Julie Kushner and Representative Robin Porter, as well as Comptroller Lembo. Senator Kushner and Representative Porter were really the architects of putting together this assistance fund, they themselves recognizing sort of the sacrifices that have been made by Connecticut essential workers during this time, but the financial burden that has been placed on them from things like lost wages and medical expenses that are related to contracting COVID-19. Mm.
So this was a legislative initiative and won approval this year. Or I should say back in 2021. Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So the legislature put this fund together. It's about $34 million, and they authorized it in June of 2021, again, to help ease the financial burden for essential workers who lived in Connecticut. One of the eligibility requirements in terms of applying for these funds is that, you know, you were a Connecticut resident, someone who lived in Connecticut, and you contracted COVID-19 and became ill and were unable to work, or in some cases, unfortunately, died between March 10th, 2020 and July 20th, 2021.
So not only can frontline workers apply or be considered for this, but also immediate family loved ones of an essential worker who was lost.
Exactly, to help those family members cover funeral costs for those individuals.
So I guess I have to ask, in between the June 21 approval and the rollout of this program in the past few weeks, have you seen most of the architecture that was approved by the legislature remaining intact up to the rollout and delivery of the program? Or have there been additional enhancements or improvements that have been able to be applied to it since it was approved back last June?
So there hasn't really been any changes to the legislation from June. What has happened is, you know, Senator Kushner and Representative Porter called on Comptroller Lembo to ask, you know, if he would take up administering this program. And since June of last year, this office has been working on with a third party vendor that we have, CCG, to put this program together, like administratively, to put together the web portal that everyone would go to be able to apply and assess their eligibility. And again, to apply for the three main things, you know, lost wages, unpaid medical expenses, or that one-time funeral benefit that I mentioned before.
Mm. So we're looking at everybody from healthcare professionals to grocery clerks and many other essential workers. Does that also include like medical responders, like ambulance personnel, EMTs, paramedics?
All essential workers who meet the eligibility requirement. And just like you said, from grocery store clerks to transit workers to bus drivers, including school bus drivers, emergency responders, you know, certain contractors, if you meet that essential worker requirement, you qualify for the program. And again, those contracted COVID-19, were unable to work or died between that March 10th, 2020 date and July 20th, 2021 date.
Hmm. And while the program can assist with lost wages, out-of-pocket medical expenses, and burial expenses, in fact, applicants who may be in certain positions may be able to apply for and qualify for two or even three of these, right?
Correct. As long as you provide sort of the required documentation in terms of lost wages, again, the medical expense receipts for the medical expenses that you paid out, you know, things like death certificates, you know, we're going through the process of assessing those applications and making sure that individuals are actually being made whole, you know, from the losses that they incurred during this pandemic.
How has your outreach been up to now? I mean, the application period opened January 3rd. It's going to run through July 20th. Did it come off the blocks with a great groundswell of applicants?
So in the time since we've launched the program, we have about 1,400 people approximately that have actually registered on the site to apply for the benefits. Out of those, we have probably another like 250 applications that are in process, meaning people are in the process of completing the applications, and another 200 or so that have been completed. We look, fortunately, to have probably the first checks going out to people in about a week or so.
Excellent. And
so we're moving along. We'd love to see that 1,400 number double and triple and quadruple. Part of the issue is that even though the programs opened up until that June 30th, 2024 date, the $34 million is awarded on a first-come, first-served basis. So right. We really are trying to reach out to as many people as we possibly can.
Okay. And sort of to wrap things up and circle back around to the other party involved here on the administrative end, that's PCG Health, right?
Correct.
So they're essentially handling kind of the day-to-day heavy lifting. Can you just expand a little bit more on how folks that are getting involved in the program are going to be interacting with that that partner?
So the main way that they're going to be interacting with the partner is to go to the website that they built, which is, you know, a very sort of like easy to maneuver website, at ctessentialworkerrelief.org, and start the process of registering and applying for the program. The other thing that PCG does, you know, they'll take in all of the information, assess the eligibility, calculate whatever the benefit is. They're doing all of that on the back end, but they also have, you know, a call center set up if there are any questions or any situations that, you know, are outliers or anomalies. They're there to answer questions and really guide people through this process. They've been a really great partner for us, not only in sort of the administrative operational side of things in terms of building this website and getting it up and running, but also, you know, in the outreach that we've been doing and continue to do to make sure that the word gets out to the right people to apply for these funds.
Okay. And I know a few minutes ago you mentioned a 2024 date. Did I get it right that July 20 of 2022 is the current application deadline?
Correct. Correct.
Okay, excellent. Well, we thank you so much, both for the visit and the initiative. Comptroller Natalie Braswell of the state of Connecticut, launching the Connecticut Essential Workers COVID-19 Assistance Fund. If you're an essential worker who was affected by COVID-19 during the pandemic, the state invites you to apply for financial relief through this new fund. And you just need to go to CTEssentialWorkerRelief.org to get started. And Comptroller Braswell, best of luck to you, and we look forward to talking with you again. Thank you for your time today. Well, we're very pleased to bring in a brand new friend of the program this morning. Friend of a friend, actually. You guys have been hearing our broadcasts and segments featuring the Connecticut Data Collaborative. And one of their partners is my guest this morning, who represents the Connecticut League for Nursing and Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce. Marcia Proto has said that Connecticut is in a very precarious situation. In fact, she says an alarm bell should be ringing because the state doesn't have nearly the number of younger nurses that are needed to replace those who are going to be retiring within the next decade, and that we really haven't moved the needle as a state on what needs to be done. So we're going to have a nice extended conversation right now with Marcia Proto. Marcia, great to meet you, and thanks for being part of the program.
John, thanks for the invitation. I'm very excited to share with your listeners what the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce has been engaged in over actually the past 8 years we've been in existence, really focused on nursing workforce data in the areas of education, supply, and workforce demand.
So if I understand correctly, part of the problem or the challenge that Connecticut is facing is, in at least the opinion of you and your colleagues, a very minimal or lack of understanding about the current nursing workforce in the state.
And I think, John, that's where really the genesis of a lot of our current challenges and how they're being manifested in today's healthcare workplace is that usually when an individual goes to receive care, he or she, you know, may meet a clinician or a physician, but really engages with the nurse for much of their care, whether they're in a hospital or long-term care setting, and even in the physician's office. And we never think twice about, is that nurse going to be there for us? So for years, our nursing workforce has been robust and able to meet needs of our healthcare system and our patients. It's just that over the past 5 years, we've had many challenges with making sure we have enough nurses. And as you know, there's different roles of nurses. We have the RN, we have the advanced practice nurse, or the APRN and LPN. And so each has a different scope of practice. And really, until about 4 years ago, we've always been able to provide enough nurses with the right training to fill the roles. But before the pandemic, and been exacerbated by the pandemic through retirements, challenging work situations, we're now finding we just do not have enough bodies trained at the right levels to meet our needs.
And I guess there's just no formalized plan at the state level, which I guess rolls downhill from the Department of Public Health to address the looming cliff, if you will, when we're going to see a period of time where many, many nurses are going to be leaving the workforce, and there just aren't enough to fill nearly those positions.
And John, you're correct. In other states around the country, and the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce is actually a member of the National Forum of State Nursing Workforce Centers. So there are 39 other workforce centers across the country, and I'm very active in that organization and involved in many of the committees. And in other states, they have chief nursing officers, whether they're located at the Department of Public Health or in their board of nursing in a paid capacity or with their Department of Labor. In our state of Connecticut, we don't have such a role. So it's organizations like ours, the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce, or the Connecticut Nurses Association that helps inform what's happening. And so since we've never really had a true crisis, I mean, we had a crisis back in 2005 where our hospitals were seeking nurses and had double-digit vacancies, but that quelled rather quickly and wasn't exacerbated by an ongoing pandemic like COVID. So even though we've been tracking data and sharing that, you know, we need more nursing faculty if we're to expand our capacity and student seats for our RN programs, it kind of fell on deaf ears because we were able to produce what our market needed. And so without this in-depth understanding and having a focal point in Connecticut to monitor in an ongoing way what our trends were, it's only these episodic spikes that have brought nursing to the forefront.
Clearly, global pandemic. Well, the stat that 6 out of 10 full-time nursing workforce members in Connecticut are over age 50. So it sounds to me like, 10, 12 years ago, when Connecticut kind of put on that push to bring, the training that it could to new nurses incoming to the field, a lot of those individuals who came on board probably were already in their 30s or even their 40s.
And that's a very good observation, John. We do have many ways that a nurse can become registered in the state of Connecticut through a 2-year associate degree program, a 4-year baccalaureate program, or what they call an accelerated program. And that's somebody with a bachelor's degree in something else who wants to go into nursing, and it's a 15-month program. And so those types of programs are attracting the career changer. So when we assume that when a nurse gets his or her license that they're starting at age, 22 to 25, and we have the life cycle of them to stay in Connecticut employment, it's now a big wrinkle. We're attracting 40 and 50 year olds to our workforce. So their horizon of working in Connecticut is not as long. Plus, with the new view of the world of work by our younger persons who don't stay in one organization for a long time and move, we really have a hard time projecting what our workforce is going to look like.
And I guess
as you alluded to, the aging is a real issue in Connecticut.
Yeah, and I guess when a lot of younger people who may be in their high school age and or even in college, and they're looking across the opportunities and fields that they might want to make a career, they're looking at a field that has a membership that looks like them. And right now, I guess, according to the survey, the race and ethnicity of Connecticut's nursing workforce is misaligned with the diversity of our state population.
Yes, and also, John, the diversity of our patient populations. Mm. So that we have to really reflect who are in those beds, who's receiving care, and as you alluded to, do we have the providers that look like them to provide the best possible care? One of the issues of why we're so challenged with expanding the diversity in our programs is we only have 2,600 available seats for nursing students. So we actually only admit 24% of the qualified nursing candidates into our schools and program each year. Mm-hmm. We don't have enough faculty to teach them. And we don't have enough clinical sites or clinical placements for our students to have hands-on experience, whether it be in a hospital, long-term care, or community care, that are required for them to complete before graduation. Each of our students needs to complete at least 500 hours of clinical experience before they even graduate. Hmm. So for healthcare and nursing specific, an internship or an externship is not a nice to have, it's a must have or they don't graduate. Hmm. So between the lack of faculty who are master's and doctorally prepared nurses, and that's how we've set it up in our state through regulation, they need to be master's prepared nurses at the RN level or above and doctoral if you're going to teach in the universities. Hmm. And for our LPN programs, we need baccalaureate prepared nurses to teach. So that's where the challenge is. Education pays about 2/3 of what a nurse can make when they're in practice. So attracting someone to the faculty role full-time or the clinical faculty role, which are the individuals to take the students in the placements, is a real challenge.
Yeah. And I must preface this by saying this is in no way any kind of a political statement or shot at anybody. But, you know, as the pandemic started to really take hold in Connecticut, I remember, you know, Governor Lamont initiating an executive order to allow some nursing students to actually help supplement the boots on the ground, so to speak, at a time when our hospitals were looking at a tsunami of incoming COVID patients, and there was still, you know, we were not as advanced as we are today in terms of knowing how to mitigate and deal with all that. So it's kind of ironic that given the fact that we were empowering student nurses in some capacity to kind of help with the COVID onslaught, we were still facing a situation where there weren't enough facilities for these nurses to do their practical hands-on piece of their education.
Exactly. And so I think when you look at it from a demand perspective, our healthcare facilities did need all hands on deck. They really did need helpers to support. And also the challenge arises is that because we don't have as many patient care techs or certified nursing assistants, we have great demand for both of those roles and home health aid roles. The nurse is then required to do a whole host of other activities that could be done by an unlicensed individual. So we want all of our nurses to practice at the top of their scope of practice, whether they're advanced practice nurses, RNs, or LPNs, so they can provide the best and high-quality care to our residents and patients in the hospital. So it's very challenging how to balance that workforce. And I think when you're really looking at what we need to drive home and have our listeners and your listeners get a better idea of, we do need to, as you alluded to, develop a systematic statewide plan to address the aging of our nursing workforce. Mm-hmm. Not only the aging, but stemming the retirements of those who are 50 years old. As you heard, people are just overwhelmed, exhausted, and are dropping out of the workforce much, much earlier than we anticipate.
Yeah.
We need to really look systemically at how are we going to expand the capacity of our nursing programs to produce more than the 2,100 graduates we do each year to meet the needs of our facilities.
Well, we're going to come back and talk a lot more about the recommendations that you and your colleagues have for the state of Connecticut to address this potentially dangerous situation where we will be losing so many nurses. Folks, we're with Marcia Proto. She is Executive Director for the Connecticut League for Nursing and Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce. Stay with us. We'll be back with a lot more information when we come back. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Hey, have you heard the news? Early bird registration is open now through May 27th. So why wait? Join BH Care for their June 4th annual A Chance to Shine celebration and benefit at Quarry Walk in Oxford. At 10 a.m., you can walk in honor of victims of domestic violence. Then the Community Fun Day continues with food trucks, live music, lawn games, a touch of truck yard for kids of all ages, and more. All proceeds raised support the critical programs of the Umbrella Center, the Parent-Child Resource Center, Hope Family Justice Center, and BH Care's Mental Health and Substance Use Services. All the critical and life-saving services BH Care provides to Connecticut adults and children. Go to achancetoshinect.org for more information. We are back with Marcia Proto. She's Executive Director for the Connecticut League for Nursing and the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce. We're talking about a study that has just been released in conjunction with her offices and our friends at the Connecticut Data Collaborative, signaling a potential disaster in Connecticut's nursing landscape with the potential loss of many of our licensed state nurses in the coming 10 years and nowhere near the number of replacements or a plan to put those replacements in place to take over for them. So, Marcia, we're seeing that Connecticut really needs to make a concerted effort to produce not just nurses, but the right number of nurses with the right academic credentials and experiences at all academic levels to meet the workforce needs across all the employment settings in Connecticut. So I'm interested in hearing about a few of the ideas that you're trying to impress on the state through your organization to answer this challenge.
Thanks, John, and excited to be back. From a best practice perspective, we need to make data-informed decisions, and that's why the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce is so excited to continue our partnership with the Connecticut Data Collaborative and Michelle Reardon-Nold and her team. So for years, the Connecticut League for Nursing and the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce does a survey of all of our schools and programs of nursing to inform us what is their seat capacity at all levels, as well as what is their faculty need and also other needs, especially in the area of simulation, because we can use simulated learning to support the students in that clinical hands-on piece. In our state of Connecticut, during the pandemic, we were able to use 50% simulation. So we were able to target the advanced practice nurses, the RNs and the LPNs to supplement their clinical placements with simulation so we could actually graduate them and they could sit for the nursing boards to seamlessly enter our workforce. Michelle and I also have been tracking the supply of our nurses in the state of Connecticut. So the report that we just released earlier this year is actually the second report that we released. We released one in 2018 to talk about where do all of our nurses work? And as you alluded to, what is their educational preparation? And so when we look at our demographics in the state of Connecticut, we only have about 50% of our nurses that work in hospitals. And so when you look at the other settings and community care and visiting nurses associations and long-term care facilities, we really don't focus on what their needs are as much. So in 2019, the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce partnered with the state of Washington, which has a healthcare demand model. We were able to work with all of the state trade associations, the Hospital Association, Leading Age Connecticut, Connecticut Association of Health Care Facilities, Home Care Association, and Assisted Living, to actually send a survey to the members to say, who do you need and what do you need and why can't you find them? And the survey that we used from Washington was on not only nursing, it was all roles in healthcare. Mm-hmm. But what came back was predominantly everybody needed nurses, certified nursing assistants, home health aides, and believe it or not, masters in social workers and surgical techs popped to the top. Hmm. So if we have this data and then can look at their education capacity in the state in those roles, we can then target dollars to those specific programs so we can grow our own and enhance capacity and graduation rates for these different roles. So I think that's so essential, is for the state to continue to fund our data initiatives that we engage in, so we really can look at the education capacity, the supply, and the demand of who we need, because in and of itself, looking at each of those data sets does not give us the true story of where we need to invest in.
Yeah.
So it really is a comprehensive lift. What we've seen is also workforce initiatives that the state has engaged in feed one side of the equation, but don't flip the levers to make a smooth transition. We get unintended consequences and bottlenecks.
Yeah.
So really looking at a comprehensive way to address not only the nursing workforce pipeline, but other roles in high demand is critical.
So clearly, we have exited the plane, and the main parachute is not deploying. So as we speak today, I guess our emergency parachute could be associated with the 20+% of Connecticut's licensed workforce who's not working in Connecticut. Is part of your plan in any way, shape, or form designed to try to create incentives at some level, state or otherwise, to try to recruit or retain and attract these out-of-state workers licensed in Connecticut back to take care of our own patients?
And that's a great concept. One of the challenges related with telehealth and providing care across, you know, our entire country, that many of these licensed nurses who are not working in Connecticut may be working for an insurance company or a pharmaceutical company or a consulting company. So they need to hold a license, but their work brings them around the country and or in Connecticut as well. So they may be employed by an organization in Texas. They may serve a little bit of Connecticut, but they may serve other geographies. So the challenge is to really look at those nurses with Connecticut licenses who are working elsewhere, drill down to what type of work they're providing. Because I don't believe all of them are providing, hypothetically, bedside nursing.
Oh, very
and
good.
That's where we get the wrinkle. Mm-hmm. So in our report that we just published, we said we have 86,000 plus licensed RNs and LPNs, but we only have 44,000 of those LPN and RNs practicing. We know that we have individuals who are 80 and 90 years old who still hold their license, because they're always going to hold their license because they're a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
So unless we really start to, as you alluded to, cross-reference with our Department of Labor data to see, you know, are these people working? Are they working as volunteers? Are they working in school systems? Or are they working in sales and marketing?
Mm-hmm.
They may keep their license. So until we truly drill really far down to see where those individuals, if they're just holding their license and maybe they're raising a family right now, or where they're working, can we truly target market to pull them back into the state?
Hmm.
We are going to be creating an opportunity to do some recruitment on a statewide basis for nursing faculty, both full-time and part-time. We have world-class education in Connecticut, and we want to draw the best of the best for our academic educators. So we will be looking at that as an opportunity come 2022, because it's expanding our education pipeline that's going to give Connecticut some additional workforce. And we also need to target those students who have gone out of state for their education, whether it's Boston or Rhode Island or New York, to come back and work in Connecticut.
Well, we've hit the end of our time, Marcia, and it really sounds like there's plenty more to talk about with you, and I'll look forward to a future conversation, perhaps in conjunction with the next round of data or study that your organization is doing in concert with the Connecticut Data Collaborative. We appreciate all your great information this morning, folks. As you heard, Connecticut is facing a real challenge when it comes to making sure all the people who need nursing care can get nursing care at the capacity and level of training that's required. And our friends at the Connecticut League for Nursing and Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce have a plan to try to make that happen. So in closing, Marcia, where can people go to learn more and maybe put their energies toward advocating for the work that you folks are trying to do to make sure everybody is best taken care of?
And John, I thank you for the opportunity. So our Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce website has all of our reports that we've done for the past 15 years in the areas of education, supply, and demand. We have resources, we have videos, we have links to Connecticut Data Collaborative, and they have data stories on our education and our supply data. So to be informed, the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce website is an ideal place. We're also going to be, again, doing a survey of our colleges, universities at the LPN and RN level to get a better handle on their vacancy rates for faculty, on their seat capacity, and on programs that they believe they can expand on. Mm-hmm. So we will be publishing a new report in April to give our state an inside glimpse of to what education can do or is doing to make sure we are expanding our enrollments to meet employer demand. So I'd love to come back in April and update your listeners on where we are and how they can support and be informed on these issues.
Well, here we are, the first program of March, and a lot of things are happening here in March, but regular listeners to the program, especially longtime listeners, know that for well over 20 years, we've been talking about resources for individuals who get stuck in the cycle of problem gambling. And March is Problem Gambling Awareness Month, which underscores the challenges of problem gambling and available resources through programs like the one we're going to talk about today at Wheeler's Bettor Choice Gambling Treatment Program. That's BETTOR. I just got that when I opened up the document here. All along, I was thinking it's a better choice, but it's a better choice, a gambling treatment program. And the person that we're talking to is a gambling problem gambling support specialist, Katie Kirsch. She's clinical supervisor for the Better Choice program. Katie, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
From your program to our program, as we said, we really started talking about resources for problem gambling here in Connecticut way back when the casinos first opened up a little over 20 years ago. And we've been talking about it ever since. But man, has it been an 18 months to beat the band in terms of opening up other options for people to kind of, think they're having fun at first and maybe winning a few bucks. But I have to imagine Wheeler's phones at the Better Choice program are now ringing off the hook. Tell us a little bit about the program and how it came to be.
So the Better Choice program, so Wheeler is actually one of five gambling treatment programs in the state of Connecticut. So we service folks from about the Hartford area all the way up to the Mass border. So we service North Central Connecticut. We have treatment locations in Hartford, Bristol, and New Britain. And our team of clinicians are, we are licensed professionals, so we hold the same licenses that you'll find if you're seeking, therapy through a private practice or anywhere else. But we have additional training in the field of problem gambling. So it's sort of unlike the treatment that you'll find elsewhere if gambling is an issue for you. So we are an outpatient level of care, so we do primarily individual therapy. We do have group treatment as an option for those who are interested. We do medication management. We treat co-occurring disorders. It's not just gambling. So people often come in with other things going on, whether there's anxiety or depression, often related to the gambling. We see high rates of co-occurring issues, some substance use. So we can sort of treat the whole person.
It's interesting that you say that, because I remember learning for the first time years ago that individuals who may have had a substance addiction who feel that they've beat it and are clean and sober, sometimes for years, if not decades, those are people that may be at least proportionally higher risk to become addicted to problem gambling, because I guess the incredible brain and the chemicals in it sort of function the same way with the juice you get out of gambling as sometimes you did from things like nicotine, cigarettes, even opioids.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, this behavior does not come without risks, and people who are in recovery from other substances are definitely a high-risk population. So it's something to just keep in mind that this is not a risk-free activity. Most people gamble, and most people don't have a problem with it, but there are, there's a group of people that will struggle with problems, and being in recovery from other things is definitely a risk factor. So something to just keep in mind.
Yeah, I guess a good way to think of it is that, you take a room full of 25 people and 22 of them can, have a glass of wine with dinner and head home a couple of hours later and everything's fine. And then you have the other few people that are having wine before dinner, for dinner, after dinner, and when they get home from dinner. And these are the people similar to those who may start out, just maybe hearing a commercial and going to, one of these new online betting sites or online gambling and entertainment programs. And then, a week later, a month later, a couple months later, they're having a hard time paying the mortgage because all the money has been sucked into the handheld.
Right. That's right. And, when I'm talking to clients, I'm often explaining this disorder very similarly to alcohol. I'll say, gambling's legal. Alcohol's legal. Most people can drink. Most people don't have a problem with it. Most people can gamble. Most people don't have a problem with it, but that doesn't mean that it's something that doesn't have risks attached to it. And we have to be aware of that. We have to know our own limits. We have to know what we can and can't afford to lose. And we have to just sort of stay on top of ourselves and, make decisions that work best for us.
So you guys have provided a really interesting statistic as a talking point today, Katie, and that is that rates of problem gambling double when people are within a certain proximity of a gambling establishment. Now, that certainly may have been an issue with off-track betting and Keno and the casinos, but now, it's also almost become cliche, but you literally, if you have a smartphone, you're holding a casino in your hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is an old statistic because, in the past, and talking to some of my older clients, it used to be that they would have to drive to Atlantic City to gamble, or they would fly out to Vegas to gamble. Then we got our casinos in Connecticut, and then it was just a 40-minute drive or a 20-minute drive for folks. Mm-hmm. So the risk, became greater and greater, and more people became vulnerable to this addiction. But exactly now, everyone's got access to it right in their hands, right in their own homes. And so, unfortunately, it will create more problems down the road. We're already seeing an increase in calls compared to the numbers last year. We've about doubled, callers to our helpline. Mm. So there's definitely already an increase, and it's happening much quicker. When MGM was built in Massachusetts, we thought, okay, let's get ready because we're going to start seeing a lot more problems in the northern Connecticut area for people reaching out for help. And they did, but it took a little bit of time. It took more like 6 months to a year for us to start getting callers that said, okay, well, I used to go to Mohegan Sun, but now I go to MGM. But with this online, it's just happening so much quicker. So from October to now, we've definitely seen a large increase in calls.
Mm. The other thing I think it's really important to talk about is how much more prevalent due to the the mobile device use, that problem gambling is infiltrating a younger and younger demographic. I mean, when I was in high school, back in the mid and early 70s, you know, we had a football card and we could check off our boxes and maybe win a couple of bucks. And, you know, that was a fad for a while. And then when the casinos opened, maybe, you know, go up there and pull a few slots or whatever. But now with the availability of gambling on mobile devices, you got to be really worried about kids, even maybe as young as middle school age, right?
Yeah, you know, we do a lot of prevention work in Connecticut, which is really fantastic to get the messaging out and to spread awareness to youth that again, they are a vulnerable population. And, you know, there are some good things in place in terms of online gambling where the legal age is 21. You do have to enter, you know, social security numbers and valid credit card information and things like that. So there are some, you know, ways to protect our youth, but they do need to know that they are certainly at risk, especially if they're highly involved in video gaming or play a lot of those games where there can sort of be a little bit of gambling elements kind of in those games. Mm. Could potentially put kids at risk for future problems down the road.
A gambling training program, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's switch gears and let people know all the wonderful and effective resources that you can help provide them through Wheeler. And I'm not just talking about individuals who may recognize in themselves or by looking at the bottom line in their bank account that they better get some support. But you're also there for the loved ones and family members who are along for the ride, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, we highly, highly encourage family members to get involved in treatment. You know, a lot of times people think, well, you know, it's my spouse or my child that has the gambling problem. They're the ones that need help. And we get a lot of calls from family members just wanting more information about our program. And, you know, I'll often say to them, you know, if your loved one isn't willing to come into treatment now, are you willing to come in? And, you know, I sort of catch them off guard because they think, well, I'm not the one with the problem. But we know that one gambler impacts up to 20 people around them, and that's family members, people in the community, their friends. This addiction does impact a lot of people. So we talk to them about how we can help them work through some of the emotions that they're feeling. They're probably feeling angry right now. They're probably feeling lack of trust in the relationship. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to help. They don't know the do's and don'ts of this addiction. How do I really help them? What should I do? What shouldn't I do? We help them work on, you know, rebuilding marriages and rebuilding financial and emotional trust again in relationships. And how can we get you guys on the same page? So oftentimes when I approach it in that way, they'll say, okay, well, you know, I actually am feeling all of those things. I am feeling hurt. I am feeling angry. I don't trust them anymore. You know, what do I do? And I'll say, well, you know, this is exactly the thing we can help you with. So we try to do family sessions as often as we can. If family members aren't willing to come in, we'll talk to our clients and say, you know, can you bring your spouse in? Can you bring your sister in? She's a big support for you. Let's bring her in and do one family session and you know, just help the whole family unit, because this addiction doesn't just impact one person. It impacts the entire family dynamics.
Very good. WheelerHealth.org/betterchoice. That's BETTORCHOICE is the website to go if you'd like to learn more about this program. But Katie, in the last 30 seconds or so that we have for people who may have joined us late here in the first weekend of Problem Gambling Awareness Month, could you just remind folks down in Fairfield and New Haven County how they might be able to access similar resources?
Yeah, the best phone number to call in the state of Connecticut, if you're not sure if my program or another Better Choice program is in your area, you can call the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling's helpline at 1-888-789-7777. They're there 24/7. They have text and chat options, and they'll guide you to the program that is closest to you.
Wheeler's program is one of five gambling-specific treat programs treatment programs funded by the Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. March is Problem Gambling Awareness Month. If you think you have an issue or someone you love does, please get in touch with the services that can give you the support and guidance that you need to wind your way out of it. Katie Kirsch is with the is the clinical supervisor of the Better Choice program for Wheeler up in Central Connecticut. Katie, we thank you for your resource this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary, while supplies last. Tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.